The new issue of the interdisciplinary journal Social Research explores how the way we write and the meaning of writing are rapidly changing. It asks how artificial intelligence transforms norms and expectations that for centuries associated writing with voice, originality, and agency. If writing is a technology that restructures thought, as philosopher Walter Ong put it, then which written forms of thought and reflection will survive AI, or conversely, will be enabled by it? What new literacies are required? How will new technologies rework the relationship between writing and the marketplace? In 9 groundbreaking articles, the summer 2026 issue of the journal tackles these and other questions that pertain to the issue's title, Writing in the 21st Century. Social Research is the flagship journal of the New School for Social Research in New York City. You can find the journal on Project Muse or at www.socres.org. That is www.socres.org.
One fine morning, I was awakened. Oh, bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. One fine morning, I was awakened to find the fascists at my door. Oh, partigiano, take me with you. Oh, bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Partigiano, please take me with you. I don't feel frightened anymore.
Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Fighting Fascism Podcast. I'm your co-host, Aaron Regenberg, and here with the lovely Matt DeSilva.
Hey, Matt. Hi, Aaron Regenberg. It's me, the lovely Matt DeSilva.
How's it going, man?
I am good. Came in at a real hot 10 there, but I don't know.
And now took it down to a real slow 4, a real sluggish 3.5.
I'm all over the place, man. I'm doing all right. What's new? I spent the weekend in Washington, D.C., where I was there for a very lovely wedding. Did spend Saturday morning kind of walking around the city a little bit. Saw like a handful of National Guard guys doing absolutely nothing. It's truly remarkable. And I almost feel bad for them wearing all those fatigues and just like playing Candy Crush. Pretty useless use of our money, if you ask me.
It's at least not going like straight into the Trump family's personal bank accounts. Like anything I look at now that's not actively blowing people up, I'm like, well.
Yeah, fair. Totally fair. I didn't make it to the reflecting pool, but I've had a lot of joy Schadenfreude, whatever. Just like seeing that the pool still sucks.
Did you see the picture of the guy who with the no bid contract who's responsible?
Yeah. He looks like a...
Just
a,
unbelievable.
He looks like a guy from Providence who was
in
the
contract. Yeah, or North Providence.
Like, yes, fair home. Enough. Yes. He does look like a guy who would have taken a like... $80,000 no bid contract to do like the parking lot of North Providence High School in 1997.
Yeah. He's behind the CVS getting a given a brown bag full of cash to one of those North Providence city councilors or Mayor Lombardi.
Allegedly.
Deep Rhode Island lore for folks. Well, I'm calling.
Aaron, are you? How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm good. I'm calling in from the, and they asked me to give a shout out, so I'm going to. From the Busy Town co-working space in Brattleboro, Vermont, because we are taking a weekend trip, and the timing worked out that I needed to come in here to record this.
It's wild that they asked you to shout them out, because it does look like you are a hostage in a barely lit room with nothing on it.
It may look like that, but it is a lovely co-working space. It's a lovely place. If you're in Vermont, don't listen to Matt, even if I might look like that a little bit.
He looks like a hostage.
But anyway, so we drove like halfway to where we're going, and now and when I'm done with this, we're going to drive the other half. We did have quite the diaper blowout in the car.
Ooh, tell us.
We've got a big mulberry tree in our yard, and right now there's like a 2-week period when it produces like 500 million mulberries, and I've just been like putting a sheet out, and they fall down, and I collect them in the sheet. And wash them off. And because our baby, our 1-year-old, is just a berry machine. He's obsessed with, he will eat so many, and their berries are freaking expensive. And so we've just had this like steady free stream from the backyard. Trees are incredible. It's crazy. It's just producing these little sweet treats for us for free out of the sun. It's crazy. Hey,
shout out fruit trees. Shout out fruit trees. We see what you're doing.
But anyway, kid's been eating a lot of mulberries, and it was very visible in the contents of this diaper, just like pitch black and everywhere.
Oh, poor kid.
Like pitch black and full of sea. It's just like,
oh, yay.
Picture that, listeners.
Was it so how long this happened in the car?
Yeah, yeah.
How long after the blowout did it take for you to get to pull over?
It was a while because he was crying and we didn't know exactly why. It was till we, yeah.
Babies just cry. Babies just cry sometimes.
Babies cry.
He's gonna. How are you to know that that cry was my diaper's full of mulberry shit cry?
Well, listeners, we have again genuinely excellent episode for you today.
It's actually kind of crazy how we're able to get such great guests.
Yeah, I don't know why these people keep coming on, but like,
it doesn't make any sense.
Our episode today is with Cory Doctorow, who is just one of the great minds of our time. Folks may have heard of Cory from his coining of the term inshittification for the process of like technology platform decay. He has written, he's like coined a million just sort of brilliant, you know, era defining terms of phrase. He is a writer of both science fiction and technology criticism. He works for many years at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which does great work on all of the topics that we're talking about. And it is a member supported institution. So if you like what you hear from Cory now, you should check them out. And we talked about a lot of things, but his new book is called The Reverse Centaur's Guide to Life After AI. And so we've already had an AI episode, but it is kind of the biggest thing going on right now. So I hope you'll forgive us doing another with someone who really is thinking about this stuff in very important ways.
Yeah. Other things to know about Cory is that he is a science fiction writer, which I think as you read his work, you get a nice flavor for kind of where some of his references come from and how he, you know, thinks through these things through the lens of sci-fi. He also has a newsletter called pluralistic.net, which you should check out. He's writing like all the time, it seems. I mean, I think we talked about it right off the top, but even just this in some ways basic idea of like centaur versus reverse centaur, I hadn't thought of AI in that context, and it's really, even in like the week since I've like read this book, I've quoted it to like every person I've talked to, because it does really, it's like a simple idea that changes the way that I've thought about these tools. And you know, Cory's gonna explain more what that is and what centaur versus reverse centaur is. We should be centaurs and not have the work done to us is sort of a simple way to put it, but he puts it better than that because, you know, he's a writer and I'm just the guy talking into a microphone.
We didn't a reverse centaur, that's like essentially BoJack Horseman, like that's if we had to actually visualize it.
I guess if you had to actually,
it's like a guy's body with a horse head would
right
be...
Right. Yeah. If you actually really have to visualize it. Yeah, I guess that's right.
Anyway, great conversation. Check Cory out.
We also talk about Whirly Ball, which so stay around for that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You got to get to the way end before we talk about Whirly Ball, but it's worth it.
Definitely worth it. All right.
So Cory, AI, and Whirly Ball coming up
right now.
Well, welcome to the Fighting Fascism podcast, Cory Doctorow. It's so great to have you.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start off talking about your new book, the title of which is The Reverse Centaur's Guide to Life After AI. Let's just jump right in. Can you start us off by sort of giving us a brief explainer of what a centaur, what a reverse centaur is, and how those those ideas fit into AI and what we're seeing with that?
Sure. So, automation and fights over its relationship to labor are not new. And there is a rich literature and history of this. And while as a civilization, we have so little object permanence that we would lose a game of peekaboo, I think that as activists, it really behooves us to like know what has happened before. And what has happened before in fights over automation has been a pattern in which when automation is driven by labor, it tends to be deployed to improve quality, whereas when automation is driven by capital, it tends to be deployed to improve throughput. And that's not just because of, the class struggle and a callous disregard for work, although that's a part of it. It's because when your relationship to automation is that it's an asset that is like rapidly depreciating off of your balance sheet, you want to use it as much as you can to maximize your return on your investment. And so bosses broadly just want to see that asset that they bought sweated. They want to sweat the asset. And since the human is the bottleneck almost always with the machine, and sometimes we get machines to do things that, and they're slower than humans or can't work as long, maybe they overheat. Broadly, when we have a new machine, it can work faster and longer than a human. And so the human is the bottleneck. And so it means that when you work the machine as hard as possible, you work the human as hard as possible, which is where we get to centaurs and reverse centaurs. So a centaur in automation theory is someone assisted by a machine. And now you can use a tool in a way that's unwise, even if you're a skilled worker. But broadly, I defer to people who know how to do things I don't know how to do. And so when someone says, I want to use this machine, and I'm going to find ways to use it that make my life and my work better, broadly, I'm just going to trust them that they're doing the right thing. And so that's a centaur, you and a spell checker, you and a bicycle, you and a grammar checker, or you and a blender instead of a hand whisk when you want to make whipped cream, right? That is a centaur arrangement. Now, a reverse centaur arrangement, as you probably figured out by now, is the opposite. It's when a human is conscripted to serve as a peripheral for a machine. So, if a centaur is a human head on a machine body where the tireless strength of that machine is being directed by a human mind to a human end, then a reverse centaur is a machine atop a human body where the remorselessness of the machine drives the human to the machine's purposes. And, this, as I say, is not new. In fact, some of our sort of most beloved cinematic beats recapitulate this. We've seen Charlie Chaplin getting ground in the gears in modern times, Ethel and Lucy working on the in the chocolate factory, putting the chocolates in the boxes, and the assembly lines running so fast that the chocolate starts, flying everywhere to great comedic effect. And that's because this arrangement where you work the machine and thus the humans attached to the machine as hard as possible, they're not unique to AI and they're very hard to escape. And that's why the most automated warehouses in America, which are Amazon's warehouses, also have 3 times the national injury rate. It's not a coincidence, and it's not an unfortunate side effect. It is core to the project of spending 7 to 8 figures on automating a warehouse that you're not going to leave that plant sitting idle. You're going to work it as fast as you can, which means you're going to work the humans at the end of the line as hard as they can.
That makes total sense. And is so like I don't know. Very intuitive. It's like I have a machine. I use a machine. I have a brain. I tell the machine to do what my brain wants me to do, as opposed to a forklift, driving me.
Yeah. Can I just say, we watched, I showed my 5-year-old Modern Times quite recently, and I was thinking about it. It had been a while since I'd seen it, and particularly during the feeding machine with the corn,
Yeah, with the
that
corn.
scene, I was thinking
Yeah.
about the Amazon warehouse thing. It is, yeah, it's not new. It's just getting more and more impressive and all-encompassing.
And again, this is why object permanence is like a critical factor for good activism. If you just act surprised every time and are surprised every time because you have lost the ability to remember what happened 10 seconds ago, then you will never effectively fight because you can't learn from the victories and the mistakes of the people who came behind. Obviously, every struggle is new and every struggle is contingent, but it shares patterns with those other struggles.
Right. I mean, I have to imagine there's, I don't know much about the labor organizing history of car plants, but I would imagine that that was a role in this. You know, the you know,
100%.
The whatchamacallit, the assembly line and whatnot. And Henry Ford, if he had his druthers, would have, you know, had people just dying on the line and replacing them immediately.
And you know, there is a little echo there in labor, automotive labor history and tech labor history, in that automotive workers, because of Fordism, were actually treated pretty well, with the exception of things like racist discrimination against Jews and Black people and so on. But, you know, the people who worked for Henry Ford just believed that they should be able to, like, afford a car, and that they should not be distracted by kind of grinding poverty. So he, you know, he built a company town, but that company town provided decent housing, right? And so a lot of those workers viewed themselves as, you know, sort of partners of Henry Ford, of stakeholders, and, you know, possibly to their detriment, in the same way that a lot of programmers think of themselves as, you know, entrepreneurs in waiting and colleagues of the people who started the company. We're all just guys wearing hoodies here, drinking the free kombucha, getting the massages. And, you know, of course, there comes a moment when the boss is like, well, actually, I am the boss, right? I mean, yes, sure, I am grateful to you for the work that you put in. You know, Jeff Bezos saying, I'm grateful to everyone who helped me buy this rocket ship, you know? but then there comes this point where you're like, well, wait, he doesn't actually think of us as being a co-equal to him. We're not a critical part of this. A big part of the project of Fordism wasn't just to make sure that we weren't distracted while we were working on the assembly line. It was to make sure that the assembly line could de-skill us so that we could be replaced if we ever got too big for our britches.
Right.
And so there is that. I think there is that echo there.
Yeah, and we're gonna talk more about tech workers a little bit later. I have a couple questions about that, but
sure.
Before we get there, you write in your forthcoming book that the most important aspect of a new technology isn't what the machine does, it's who it does it for and who it does it to.
Yeah.
So in terms of AI, sure. who are these machines working for and who are they working on?
Well, to answer that question well, I think we need to maybe take a step back and talk about the nature of this bubble. Where does this bubble come from? Where do all bubbles come from? And where does this bubble come from? Because those are sort of the two questions that I'm asking, is the origin of tech bubbles and the nature of this one. So there's a paradox of the monopoly capitalism that was ushered in by the neoliberal changes of Carter and Reagan and then subsequent administrations that encouraged monopolies, which is that when a company corners its market, it ceases to be a growth stock and it becomes a mature company. And growth stocks are valued very highly by the stock market. And it's not because endless growth is the ideology of a tumor, as we leftists are prone to say. Mm-hmm. It's because a share in a company is a claim on its future earnings. And so if you have two companies, both making $1 million a year, but one of them is doubling in income every year, a share in its future earnings is worth more than the company that's only making $1 million every year, every year, every year. And so for just like a very good reason, markets want growth stocks. And that means that the executive team of the firm are also very interested in maintaining their status as a growth stock, because growth shares are highly liquid. They can be used to hire people. And indeed, many of the, if not all of the people on the executive side of the company will be paid primarily in shares, which means that if the company becomes a mature company and its shares fall by 50% or 75% or even more, that's their net worth falling with it, right? Right. The person who stands the most to lose the most from a Facebook stock crash is Mark Zuckerberg, followed by all of his top executives. And so on the one hand, they have a very good personal material reason unrelated to ideology to want to have continuous growth. And then they have another material reason that is related to the firm, which is that highly liquid growth shares can be exchanged for other companies, right? You can buy companies and continue to grow by buying them with your stock. And the amazing thing about stock, if you're a company, is that you make it on the premises. Right? New stock comes from typing zeros into spreadsheets.
Right.
Whereas if you have to bid with money because you have a boring, mature company whose shares aren't nearly so liquid, you can't make it on the premises. You try that, the Treasury Department shows up and takes you away in handcuffs. You have to get it from an investor or a creditor or a customer. And so these strong material reasons are why, as we see monopolies saturating their markets in tech, we see the series of increasingly sweaty narrative adventures to convince people that they can keep growing even though they have 90% market shares. And so some of that is like claiming they're going to grow to become each other. Facebook will become Google by means of the pivot to video. Google will become Facebook by means of Google Plus and so on. Eventually, we just depart the realm of reality entirely and we move into the fantasy realm of crypto, NFTs, blockchain, of course, metaverse and so on, which, you know, on the one hand, nobody knows what these things are worth. Right? We know how much Facebook is worth. They publish a quarterly report, but we don't know how much blockchain is worth because they just made it up. Like whoever made it up is the world expert on blockchain. And they're the ones with the most insight, at least as far as some people are concerned, into what it will be worth someday. And so that growth story is very powerful. But eventually people notice that no one buys anything with cryptocurrency. And you need a new narrative, right? You've got to keep running across the river on the backs of those alligators without losing a leg. And so we get the narrative after narrative after narrative, and then we get AI. But AI is different because it's much, much bigger. Okay. And so why is AI much bigger? Well, partly it's material. I'm a pretend computer scientist. I have an honorary doctorate in CS from the Open University. And as a pretend computer scientist, I understand why computer scientists are excited about AI, because we have a well-established technique for machine learning. We try a minor variation on about 10 years ago. And instead of getting a minor variation in the output, it's a little better. It's a lot better. Right? It's achieving the goals much better than we thought. So that's a breakthrough. It's a piece of low-hanging fruit. And when we get low-hanging fruit, that's always very exciting. But what almost never happens is that the low-hanging fruit reveals a bunch more low-hanging fruit. And that's what happened with AI. Right? One of the material things about AI is that if you do AI harder, it keeps getting better, which is why they're just hyperscaling. Now, anything that can't go on forever eventually stops. And they reached limits to the return to scale. But the return to scale was really important. And I wouldn't have been surprised if in the wake of the AI breakthroughs, what we got was like Sandia National Labs or ETH Zurich, or maybe like Skunkworks at one of the big companies putting a bunch of money into this. Maybe like the IPCC would say, oh, wow, you've got a machine that does really hot multivariate analysis. Build us a $100 billion version of that so we can model the climate, right? That would have been like unsurprising at all, given how interesting this is. But that's not what we got. We got a $1.4 trillion stock bubble in this stuff, an investment bubble, not stock. Most of them aren't public yet, but a $1.4 trillion investment bubble on a sector that's making $50 billion a year. $50 billion sounds like a lot until you put it up against a trillion. And then, oh my God, that's just not very much money. It is without question the money losingest thing the human race has ever done.
Wow.
And so, yeah. And so why? Where did this come from? Well, I think if you're a billionaire, you kind of live the AI future anyway. You know, William Gibson said the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed. If the AI future is one in which you're just surrounded by psychophants who glaze you from, you know, the moment you roll out of bed into the moment you collapse, then that's the future billionaires live in. No one ever tells them their ideas are stupid, no matter how stupid their ideas are. And so they get to pretend that they're experts in everything forever.
They don't have to look anything up. They can have their assistants look things up.
They're just
plan a vacation.
Like living, you know, they're living their best lives, right? So on the one hand, I think some billionaires just believe in it. Also, because to be a billionaire is to be a solipsist, right? Like you can't really believe that other people's pain is as important as your pain, because then you couldn't inflict all the pain that was needed to become a billionaire. That's just like, it's just not possible. And so I think billionaires are often solipsists, but I also think billionaires are keenly attuned to how much bosses would like to replace workers with machines, to how attractive it is to someone who is every day haunted by the knowledge that while they fancy that they're in the driver's seat, they know that if they don't show up for work, everything continues as per normal. But if the workers don't show up, everything stops. And so maybe they're in the back seat with a Fisher-Price steering wheel. And a billionaire goes, wow, we have a machine that lets you wire the steering, the toy steering wheel directly into the car's drivetrain. I bet we could sell a million of these. Even if it doesn't work, bosses will buy this happily. And so here's where we come to how who it does it for and who it does it to, and who it does it for is workers, or bosses rather, and who it does it to is workers. Because you couldn't raise $1.4 trillion on, we will let workers improve the quality of their output according to their own needs. This has to be about firing workers.
Corey, this is sort of a little tangent, but I love your blog posts, and they're always like these different topics. And I just want to put a plug for maybe a possible topic, but just how you were just talking about how these companies think about when they are a growth stock, their stock. I mean, it really is like when you're in that position, you're like a sovereign nation with your own fiat currency. And as an MMT-er myself, I feel like some exploration of like what it means for these companies to essentially be a like modern monetary theory sovereign, controlling their own fiat currency is like kind of, it's interesting.
That is an interesting thought. It's an interesting angle. I have written about this, but not in those terms. I've sort of fainted at MMT only because the arguments you get into when you talk about MMT with people who believe in neoclassical accounts of money are so tedious. But it's definitely an interesting angle to approach this at.
You write in your book about this idea of inevitabilism. This frame by these big tech oligarchs that's very useful to them. Can you just sketch out like what you mean by that and what role does it play in this AI scam that we are all living right now?
Well, the OG inevitabilist was Margaret Thatcher, cursed be her name.
That's the full title for listeners.
Yeah. She was very fond of saying there is no alternative. She said it so often that they actually called her Tina Thatcher sometimes, as in there is no alternative. There is no alternative is grossly offensive to me as a science fiction writer, because my job is thinking of alternatives, but also as a political actor, you know, what an obvious palmed card, what a really stupid sleight of hand to say, don't even try and think of an alternative. This is not me doing something to you. This is the nature of reality. It is what it is. I regret that I have to do this to you, but this is the way that it all works. And if the market,
how
says
could there be a different way of organizing the world than one person has $1 trillion and everyone else has shit? That's natural. How could we even imagine something else?
You know, if the market says that we all have to roast to death as we destroy the only planet capable of sustaining human life in the known universe, then who are we to argue with the market?
Who are we?
Right. You know, and so it's such a transparent ruse. I think it gives a bad name to good, hardworking, transparent ruses. and so I find it very offensive. And it's the thing that tech bosses really want. They want to say that there's no way that we can use AI except to have it driven by capital, used only to immiserate labor, used only in this hyperscaled way, used against the backdrop of these nonsensical stories of AI waking up and becoming God. That, you know, one of the most chilling things I've read was an account by an NIH insider who said that he begged the Doge boys not to shut down these long-running cancer research projects. And they said, well, we don't need cancer research because the AI is going to wake up soon and then it'll solve cancer. I think
wake up.
Well, and again, as a science fiction writer, it's very embarrassing to have these guys, you know, read our futuristic parables that we wrote and treat them as predictions or as roadmaps or as business plans. Like, come on, guys. As William Gibson says, cyberpunk was a warning, not a business plan. So, you know, that I find it very offensive, and I think that one of the disservices that we can do to our own cause as progressives who are hoping to have a better world is to insist that there is something intrinsic to the nature of AI that causes it to look this way, right? What we are doing is reinforcing their own inevitabilism. We're agreeing with them. When we say that this is the only way AI could be, we are agreeing with AI bosses. In the same way as like Mark Zuckerberg would like you to think that there's no way for you to have friends without him listening in on your conversations, he would like you to think that there's no way to have AI except for this disgusting way that he's rolling it out. And so, you know, as leftists, as critics, as people who want to sort of blow up the Ponzi scheme, we should be at least technically competent to describe other ways that AI could be and where the parts of it that are fine, you know, and again, like, it's silly to be anti-AI per se, right? Like, it doesn't make any sense to be against statistical inference. That's just weird, right? Statistical inference is just a thing that we use to know stuff about the world, and using models, increasingly powerful models to automate statistical inference and solve like big gnarly multivariate problems, you know, that is like not bad. It's just a normal thing that we've done for a long time and that we will continue to do pretty much forever, because statistics are a really powerful way to know more about the world. We can't be anti-statistical inference. So what we can say is we are against, you know, the billionaire agenda, we're against immiseration, we're against reverse centaurs, we're against surveillance, right? And also we think that people who, like workers who want tools that act as kind of plugins to their existing tool suite, we broadly think that workers are best equipped to tell us which tools they need, and we believe that workers should be in charge of when and how they use those tools. Like, those are fully consistent patterns. You don't have to become the guy who's like, you know, well, statistical inference is just evil, you know?
Yeah.
Reading your book has been kind of very concretely useful for my own organization of my head on this stuff, because I have been extremely anti-AI overall because of all these things, but I have interpreted it and sort of synthesized it in my head as, okay, I'm against AI. And it has been, I'm a lawyer in the climate accountability space, and I've been feeling some tensions recently, because there's a lot of dumb, shitty ways that lawyers are using AI that are really embarrassing and pathetic. But there are some incredibly powerful discovery tools. Sure. And when you're going up against these big companies and they're sending you terabytes, you know, millions and millions of documents, and it just takes an immense amount of capacity to sort through, and it is a strategy of theirs to overwhelm you so that you can't find what's useful in the ways that they broke the law. There are programs that allow like one lawyer to sort of be 10 lawyers in doing discovery work. And that, you know, I have been trying to sort of figure out how do I synthesize that with my hatred of this, and you saying, no, it's okay to like recognize that there can be value, there can be centaurs. The problem are the fucking oligarchs who are ruining everything.
Yeah. And I can give you a really concrete example of some lawyers who are doing that stuff, which I use in the book, which is the Innocence Project New Orleans, which is partnered with the Human Rights Data Analysis Group, who are, you know, the OG human rights statisticians. They've been doing this since, you know, South African Truth and Reconciliation, where they use rigorous statistical modeling to describe the aspects of human rights abuses that are not in the record because of the chaos of civil war, genocide, and so on, but that we can infer from all the other things that are in the record, right? And they then explain this to judges and juries, and it's really important work. And with Innocence Project, what they're doing is identifying the linguistic correlates of arrest reports that have previously led to successful exonerations. And then they're taking all the other arrest reports and they're saying, are these similar to the arrest reports where we got exonerations? And if so, we can start there, right? It's not saying that that's your lawyer. Your lawyer is not the algorithm. What happens is when the lawyer is trying to figure out what should we start with, that's where they start.
Right. We've started talking about the bubble. There's a lot more bubble stuff to talk. Be interested just to ease us back into that. What is the role of Crita hype in building up this bubble scam? And I think we all agree that the AGI pitch in relation to the current technology as it exists is profoundly stupid. But for listeners, can you explain, as part of that Crita hype explanation, why it's profoundly stupid?
Well, first, credit where it's due. The term Crita hype comes from the wonderful STS scholar at Virginia Tech, Lee Vinsel. And it's basically, you take the outlandish claims of hucksters trying to run a stock swindle and you repeat them verbatim, and then you put at the end of it in parentheses, and that's bad. You know, so Mark Zuckerberg says, hey, I have developed a mind control ray. I am Cyber Rasputin. I have done what Mesmer and MK Ultra failed to do using big data. And that's the reason your grampy is a QAnon, but it also means that I can sell anything to anyone. And then Mark Zuckerberg critics run around and they go like, Mark Zuckerberg is Cyber Rasputin. He's the reason my grampy is a QAnon. And that's terrible. And then Mark Zuckerberg's sales staff go out on a sales call and they say, well, why should you give an extra 40% to Facebook to advertise there? Well, you know, my critics will tell you, boss is Cyber Rasputin, and he can convince anyone of anything because he's just he's built a mind control ray. And, you know, like, this is not how you hurt Mark Zuckerberg's interests. You know, we have to attune ourselves to the kind of material likelihood that he was able to do this and do a little kind of reasoning here and say, actually, mind control rays are really hard and probably impossible. And there are a lot of other more parsimonious explanations, like maybe Grampy was always racist. And what Mark Zuckerberg has done is he's introduced Grampy to a bunch of other racists so they can hang out together without having someone around who's like, stop being so goddamn racist. And because of that, he's becoming progressively more racist. And the most important thing in his life has become his racism. And that doesn't require that you have a mind control ray. It just requires that you have a monopoly on how people connect to each other, which I think we can all stipulate that Mark Zuckerberg has. And so in the case of AI, you know, the AI companies really want you to believe that they can do some outlandish things, right? They say that if they shovel enough words into the word guessing machine, that it's going to wake up and become God. And this is very silly, right? It's like saying that if we breed our horses to run faster and faster, one of them will give birth to a locomotive, right? It's, you know, a human being is not a word guesser who knows more words than Claude. And while I am a materialist and I think that everything that happens in the brain happens to atoms interacting with other atoms, and so I won't rule out the possibility that we'll make some other atoms in the future that can do some or all of the things that a human brain can do, including the parts that we call consciousness, I don't think that that's what word guessing is. And I don't think anyone's made a really good case that that's what word guessing is. And so we have to stop going around and saying, as the so-called AI safety advocates do, we have to tame this technology before the word guessing program turns us all into paperclips. And we have to start saying, how ridiculous is it that people think that this word guessing program can turn us into paperclips if we just teach it enough words? That's just not how any of this stuff works. I was just at a conference where one of the larger, more prominent AI boosters approached me to say, well, you know, we've got AI that is now 51% of the way to human consciousness. And I'm like, what does that benchmark mean? Like, what would a 52% conscious AI consist of? How different would it be? Do you even know what consciousness is? And he's like, kind of a binary. I don't know what. And he was like, no, I don't know what consciousness is. So how could I know if it's not conscious? And I'm like, well, I don't know what the weather is in Spain, and I don't know what the weather is in Paris. It doesn't mean that they have the same weather. That's just dumb. Right. And so, you know, we can be smarter.
I don't know what consciousness is, but I can tell what 51% consciousness is.
I can tell you what 51% of it is. Yeah. And so, you know, like, these guys are doing some pretty stupid stuff, and we don't have to be as stupid as they are. We don't have to accept it on their terms. And I think that that's like, that's really the lesson of Krita hype here. And, you know, that includes things like, we can talk about the aesthetics of AI art. I think they're bad. But we can also talk about the reality of AI art, which is that if you have to make back $1.4 trillion before AI art and the AI sector starts making money, and that comes from displacing workers, we should be saying the fact that the total salaries of all the illustrators in the world don't add up to the kombucha budget for one training run of Midjourney, and that, like, irrespective of what you think of the aesthetics, which I think are terrible and don't get better, I think they're rancid for reasons we could discuss later. Okay. Even if you like them, you have to acknowledge that, like, selling $100 bills for $1 a piece is not a thing that you're going to ever make money on if the major use for it is reproducing things that don't pay very well.
I could have used this. I could have used you a week ago, Corey. I was at a wedding reception, and I'm an actor. My wife is an actor, and so we don't really engage with. And we're both primarily stage actors. We don't really engage with this shit much, right? We just don't have to for our jobs.
Right.
And we met an AI booster in the wild at this wedding.
That's what it was.
We were talking about, he's a lawyer at, like, I think Anthropic or whatever. Don't sue me.
Right.
We were talking about this anecdote from a friend who produced a podcast and had someone, a composer he'd worked with before, send him some music. And our friend, the producer, was like, this is not you. This is not your work. This feels like AI. And he ran through
Right.
checkers, and through a series of conversations, this composer kind of admitted, like, yeah, I use some AI. And this guy kind of parachuted in and was like, well, if the music was good, would he have cared? And we were like, first of all, like, we just told the story, the music wasn't good. Second of
Right.
all, like, why is that where you go? And anyway, it turns into this whole thing. My wife at one point was like, if you were really moved by a song and the lyrics really like moved you and you like emotionally, whatever, and then you found out that a robot wrote the song, wouldn't that matter to you? And now I'm realizing we pro our
Wouldn't
line
that
of
be
attack is
profoundly embarrassing?
right. Yeah, also that. And he was like, no, as long as it's a good song, whatever. But now I'm kind of realizing that I think our line of argument was actually wrong. And like in some ways, the better argument is like, what's the point? Like, why have the AI write the music? Like, writing the music, people like to write music. It's great.
Yeah, I agree. And I also think that, maybe we can get into a little metaphysics here, that, the thing that distinguishes art from things that are aesthetically striking or even beautiful is intent, right?
Right.
If you're an atheist anyways, the sunset doesn't want to tell you anything, right? The sunset is just the interplay, and often the very beautiful interplay of the sun, the atmosphere, and so on. And while those are important phenomena, some of my most important experiences involve photons. They are not intentional phenomena. There's no there. It has nothing to say. And so we are, as a species, until recently, we were very unlikely to come into contact with a thing that looked like a picture, but no one painted it, or a thing that looked like a book or a sentence, but no one had written it. And because the aesthetics of art involve trying to understand what the artist meant, even if you never can, right? I don't think it matters whether there's a whole argument about whether you can ever know what the artist meant, or whether what the artist meant matters to how you experience it. But the reason that you view a painting of a sunset differently from the sunset is because someone meant something by it. And the AI doesn't mean anything, but we hallucinated a meaning for it because we have never encountered the seeming of meaning without, or seeming of intention without an intender. But now that we have encountered that, now that we encounter it with sort of dismal regularity, I think that that's one of the reasons that this stuff is getting so washed so quickly, why it's regressing to the means, even faster than, some of the other like things that sort of tricked our psyche, like, Upworthy headlines, where for a minute there, none of us could help but click, 11 facts about socks you won't believe number three. But after a while, that stimulus just regressed, and we knew that actually three was just not as important as you thought it would be, and it couldn't be as important as you thought it would be, and they just became washed. We just stopped paying attention to them, and I think that, that's what's happening with AI art really quickly. But do you use, AI to help you cut things out when you make a collage, or do you use AI to as a video editor to change the sight line of all the extras? Because someone
I can
intends
imagine
that.
using it to learn lines for a play, right? Like, if there was a
Sure.
good device that could help me do that, and I could
Yeah.
see that as a tool that would be helpful for me.
Maybe it comes up with mnemonics or something, or
Sure.
tells you where you're struggling, or I don't know. I've never had to learn less, thankfully. But yeah, I have some glorified flashcard maker. Well, okay, maybe making flashcards is part of how you learn for some people, and maybe for others, it's just the flashcards themselves. So who knows, right? And again, like back to reverse centaurs, broadly, I defer to workers and other people when they tell me that this tool is how is making their jobs better and not worse. And so, one of the things of the reverse centaur paradigm is that it resolves the seeming conundrum, which is how do you get two groups of workers who are historically reliable narrators of their own experience, who use the same tool for the same purpose, but one of them says this is terrible and the other one says this is amazing. What you find, I think, always is that they're just, it's the differences who's making them do it, who's in charge of the experience.
I feel like one of my most hopeful takes on this sort of metaphysics question is that the the barrage of intense lists slop. It seems like for some people it's having the effect of sort of making people value intent, like actually value non-slop, sure, real stuff more. And I don't know how widespread that'll be, but as we keep going down this road, it does seem possible that the overwhelming horrors of the slop could create more of a mass backlash. I'm not sure. We were talking about on the Critihype point, and we've talked about the loss of jobs. A lot of that Critihype is around this narrative of AI destroying jobs, which is also real. There's real concerns there. That is the reason to invest in this, as you said. You argue in this book and elsewhere that not that there's no political value to that paradigm, but that a more politically salient angle to focus on for all of us who want to fight this this oligarchical way that this is happening is how AI is going to ruin shit for consumers, how it's going to make everything, services, et cetera, worse, and sort of the solidarity that can come between people and workers and how we're all getting fucked over in the same way. Can you tell us about your sort of the sure, okay, what do we do analysis on that front?
So I guess what I would say just as a minor redirection of that is that I think that what I'm trying to get at is not that a narrative about reduced quality for consumption is a substitute for a labor narrative, but they're powerful adjuncts, that the two of them together, this is going to make my job shitty, and it's going to make the things that you get that I historically would have produced for your benefit even shittier. That's a much stronger pitch. So I'll give you an example, because this is something that comes up a lot when we talk about AI, is AI in radiology. And it's an area where I have a lot of interest because I have a very treatable form of cancer. And in fact, I am cancer-free as of 2 days ago.
Woo!
Thanks to—
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And it's a thing that I know because a radiologist told me so, right? So this is a thing that I'm like very, very interested in for very personal reasons. And I think that if the story that radiologists or their supporters tell is hospital administrators have found a way to make radiology too cheap to meter, and they're going to fire all the radiologists and replace them with AI. Because as we know, AI can find some tumors that radiologists miss, which I think may be true. I'm not a radiologist, but you know, I read the peer-reviewed paper, and to my tiny brain, it seemed plausible. If that's our story, then I think there are a lot of people with cancer who are going to say, and people who love people with cancer, look, I feel bad for the radiologist, but surely the point of radiology is to cure cancer and not to employ radiologists. And if we can cure cancer without employing radiologists, and we can cure more cancer because we're not spending money on radiologists, let's do it. But that's not what's actually happening, right? What bosses at hospitals want to do, or rather what investors in AI are betting hospital administrators want to do, is fire most of the radiologists, have the AI process x-rays at a rate that no radiologist could ever adequately oversee, but nevertheless take the remaining radiologists who are now in fear of their jobs and their lives because all their colleagues have been fired, and bully them into signing their name at the bottom of the radiology reports. And then when someone dies, you blame the radiologist. It becomes what Dan Davies calls an accountability sink. Mm. And so if that's the story, and if there's another story that's even better, which is for cancer patients, which is actually what we should do is get the algorithm that can sometimes find tumors that radiologists miss, and have the radiologist process the same number of x-rays they were processing before. But if the algorithm thinks that maybe they missed something, they can go and have another look, which means that they'll go a little slower. So we're going to hire another radiologist to pick up that slack, and we will be more accurate and fewer people will die. I think lots of people would be in favor of that. One group who would be adamantly opposed to it, of course, are AI investors, who understand that that is a very shitty sales call to send a salesperson out on, and that they are going to not sell a lot of licenses on that basis. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, I've also heard from radiologists who say, well, right now we have enough labor power that mostly we do get to use these tools in ways that we prefer. And like, if we're going to maintain that labor power, we need to tell the story about AI that says, however good AI is at spotting tumors, it is good at spotting tumors as an adjunct to a human, not with a human as an adjunct to the AI.
That's like, again, like the classic centaur, reverse centaur.
Reverse centaur, yeah.
That's, I don't know, all this stuff is like so fucking cool. Or just like so elucidating. Yeah, I feel like we just jumped right into the conversation, but I didn't like get to say at the top that like everyone should read your shit because it's truly like paradigm shifting. I read Inshittification a couple months ago and I've been telling everyone like, you have to read this book.
Thank you.
We're talking a bit about like, you know, strategies for building solidarity in, you know, broad-based solidarity in sort of like the fight against the AI bubble, I guess we can call it.
Yeah.
You lay out in your new book about how reverse centaur theory or the reverse centaur application of AI has basically made it possible for Amazon to treat its coders, who we were talking about earlier, similar to like the way that Ford used to view his car workers, right? Like the coders were the privileged crown jewel of
the princes of labor.
Exactly. Yeah. Could do no wrong. All the kombucha you can drink, all the ping pong you can play.
As many surgeons as you need to remove your eggs so you can work through your fertile years.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Right. And that now basically with the advent of AI, they are being treated with the same disregard and lack of humanity that Amazon has been known, has been famous for treating their delivery drivers and warehouse workers for years.
Yeah, it's worth, if we're trying to understand like kind of the ideological basis for the bubble, it's worth looking at who the promoters of the bubble are most anxious to replace with software. And that's coders. Mm. And I think that when you look at the historic nature of programming work, in this century, what you see are, as I said, the princes of labor, workers who were in short supply, but also very, very productive. So when a Silicon Valley firm adds an engineer to their payroll, they on average are getting about $1 million more on their bottom line at the end of the year. And you know, this is why you get the free kombucha, right? There's you're worth $1 million to your boss. And because you're worth $1 million to your boss and there aren't enough people who can do what you can do, there's 10 other bosses at the factory gates who would love to give you a job, and your boss can't find someone to do your job if you quit. And so you get a lot of power. And I think that the downside of that is it made a lot of workers think that they were really actually not workers at all. They were temporarily embarrassed founders. They were entrepreneurs in waiting. And, you know, when they had the power of scarcity, they didn't backstop it with the power of solidarity by unionizing. And so we have really low union density in the tech sector. And so bosses are very, very interested in replacing workers with AI, and tech workers especially, because tech workers are mouthy and entitled, and you can't make them do stuff they don't want to do because they're hard to replace. And I think that as these firms have acquired, you know, cornered their markets and acquired monopolies, they have gotten in the position where if they fire a bunch of tech workers and the result is that their products don't work very well, they believe that they are so insulated from that because they don't have competitors. They're part of a cartel that essentially colludes to rig the market, that they don't have to worry about it. They don't have to worry about you taking your business elsewhere, because what are you going to do, right? Mm-hmm. This is what Lily Tomlin to joke about when she would pretend to be an AT&T operator on Saturday Night Live. She'd say, "We don't care. We don't have to. We're the phone company." And right. So, you know, we see that companies deploy AI for functions that whose quality they don't care about, which is why we saw it first with customer service, why we see it used a lot by spammers, why we see it used for marketing copy, why we see it used for illustration by, you know, bosses who used to just use shitty clip art, right? If you don't care if it's done well, then AI is great. AI is sort of the perfect solution for you. And they used to have to care whether the programming was done well, but they don't have to anymore.
Yeah, it's the every poster at a bodega in New York City is now an AI image generated.
Yeah.
But it really, it's worth underlining here, just the, you know, from a political strategy perspective, we've talked on this show in some previous episodes a lot about the, you know, the revolt against AI data centers and the sort of remarkable political potential in this moment of regular people across the country coming right. together to stand up to billionaires and winning.
Right.
And I think it's worth. And we bring sometimes AI into that a bit, into the, you know, the actual concrete material manifestation of this tech in data centers. But this idea that like how this AI is working, how it's being rolled out, what the goals are, it essentially really lays out the stakes of how we should have and maybe could have solidarity so much broader across workers than it currently is. And that it is like everyone who works and the billionaire oligarchs and like their, you know, their sycophants. Yeah. Those are the sides. And and maybe this can really help elucidate to people which side they're on.
Yeah. And, you know, like maybe to take, to jump here a bit to copyright and what I think of as a tactical mistake that advocates for creative workers are making. And I should say, I am a creative worker. That's my job. I write novels and books. That's the majority of my income. And, you know, I have observed many times, and I wrote a book about this, that the copyright has been a failed experiment in enriching creators, that we have made copyright last longer and we've made it cover more kinds of work and we've created higher statutory damages and the media companies have gotten richer and the share of income going to creators in real terms and proportionately is smaller than it's ever been. So they're making more money off our work and we're making less, even though we have more rights. And the question is, how could that possibly be? And the answer is, well, when you get more to bargain with, but you're bargaining against, you know, 5 publishers, 4 studios, 3 labels, 2 companies that control all the apps, and 1 company that controls all the ebooks and audiobooks, getting more to bargain with is getting more to bargain away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we see like one group of workers who are able to defend themselves from AI in their workplace, one group of creative workers, and it's the screenwriters. And they didn't do it by demanding more copyright, because, you know, what we know is that when you demand more copyright and you get it, what your boss does is he changes your contract. So whatever new copyright you just got from Congress, now he gets as a condition of doing business with you, and that becomes non-negotiable. So they didn't demand more copyright. What instead they did was exploited the fact that they had what's called a sectoral bargaining right. And sectoral bargaining is something that was outlawed for nearly every worker in America in 1947 with the Taft-Hartley Act. And the Taft-Hartley Act made it illegal for all the workers in a sector to get together and demand a contract from all the employers in a sector. So, you know, you can't have everyone who drives for Uber or Lyft or a taxi company all bargain together against all the companies that employ them. But you can have everyone who writes screenplays bargain together against everyone who purchases screenplays. And that's how the writers do it. And so we look at, you know, this possibility, this kind of fork in the road, where on the one hand, you could say, okay, what we're going to do is demand more copyright. This is a thing that no other worker in America cares about and that our bosses love. Or we could demand sectoral bargaining, which is the thing that every other worker in America needs and that our bosses would rather drink a gallon of piss every morning before breakfast than allow, right? And I just think that, you know, you don't even have to like be an expert on labor or copyright or whatever to just say like broadly, if you're asking for something your boss loves and other workers are indifferent to, and the alternative is something that other workers want and your boss hates, you should just like, just maybe take a minute. Take a beat there and ask yourself if you're on the wrong side. Yeah.
So we've talked about the AI bubble in a few different ways. Is there any sort of aspects of the mechanics of how it works that it's worth to lay out for listeners beyond what we've already said? And then, you know, what happens when it pops? How should we be thinking about that?
Well, I guess what I'll say is that to the extent that what these systems require is a human in the loop to catch the mistakes that they make, which is the industry term for someone who marks the AI's homework, that we should remember that because what these things are doing is statistical inference, which is to say they're absorbing the corpus of everything that was ever done and then trying to do stuff that's more like that, that the errors they make tend to be subtle and very hard to spot, that being a human in the loop is really hard if you're the AI's human in the loop, because the kinds of errors that they make are statistically indistinguishable from not making an error. So for example, if you're a programmer, the errors that your AI code assistant makes when they infer what the name of a library might be. So say all the text processing libraries are called something like lib.txt.txt, lib.txt.rtf, lib.txt.doc, lib.txt.pdf, lib.txt.html. But actually, because of a mistake that was made somewhere where two sets of libraries were merged, the HTML one is called lib.html.txt. The AI is going to guess, based on the pattern, that it's lib.txt.html. And the reason that matters is because there's a kind of malicious attack called slop squatting, where you make guesses about which bad guesses the AI is going to make. You say, oh, the AI is going to infer that there's a library with this name, and you register a library with that name. You make it do all the things the other library does, so it passes all the unit tests, and then you fill it with malicious code, which gets compiled right into the program. And
malicious code meaning what?
Like stuff that steals data from users, stuff that takes over their computer and sends spam or mines crypto or participates in denial of service attacks, any of these other things, you know, okay. Or scrapes the web for AI or whatever, right? Things that viruses, you know, okay. bad code. And so not only is this a mistake that is very critical, but it's also a mistake that's very hard to spot. And that is intrinsic to AI, that the mistakes that it makes are mistakes that are statistically very similar to the truth. This is why lawyers find it very hard to look at a list of case citations and guess which ones they should double check, because it will generate the maximally plausible case citations, which, you know, I'm not saying that disqualifies using AI to figure out, you know, to help you find cases. I mean, Westlaw has been using various kinds of text mining tools since forever, right? It's like you can't be a lawyer without text mining tools to figure out your citations. Fine. But it is to say that, like, we should not pretend that that this is easy, or that we hand wave away this thing and say, oh yeah, you just put a human in the loop. The human in the loop is doing something really hard and maximally hard, specifically because this is AI and because of the way the AI makes guesses.
So what happens when it pops?
Yeah. Well, this is where the fascism comes in.
Yeah.
Partly because we only have one trick that we do when we get economic crisis, which is austerity. And there's pretty good empirical literature that austerity makes people suckers for fascists. And, you know, there's just a really good paper that came out in the UK that tracked the relationship on a polling station level, level of granularity, track the relationship between votes for the fascist party, the Reform Party, who are currently doing, you know, racist pogroms in Northern Ireland, and having your doctor's clinic shut down.
Wow.
Because of austerity, having your NHS clinic shut down. And the authors conclude, I'm not going to be able to give you verbatim here, but the authors conclude something like, when you lose your doctor or something else that's really important to you, and someone says that an undeserving other from away is the reason that you've lost something that you need to survive, that makes you very liable to believe that account, right? That those two things run in lockstep. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very true. So this is the risk, because currently 35% of the S&P 500 is seven AI stocks, the so-called Magnificent Seven.
So fucking insane.
Yeah. And six of them are losing money. And the seventh one makes money selling things to the ones that are losing money, which is NVIDIA. And so that's a scary prospect. So I think I said this earlier. There's an aphorism in finance. It's called Stein's Law, and it holds that anything that can't go on forever eventually stops. And you cannot just lose money forever and just make it up by bringing in new suckers at the bottom of the pyramid who will prop up and bail out the people who came before. And so there will come a point at which they either they unload it on normies, which is the thing that Elon Musk is trying to do by having his IPO go straight into the indexes without any what's called seasoning, which is when a share that debuts on the market has to show multiple consecutive quarters of growth and profitability before it can be included in the stock indexes that we all put our savings into. You know, because that's what we've all been told to do. This is what Warren Buffett told his wife, right? When I die, take all the money and put it in a stock index tracker fund. And so, you know, Musk is trying to debut in the index before his money furnace has had a chance to reveal that you can't lose money forever and keep going on. Now, the other piece of finance lore that's really important to keep in mind here, though, is that the market can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. So I don't know when the bubble is going to burst. I don't have stock advice for you about like when to get out. Right. I mean, I will say that like you could do worse than putting your money in laser tag arenas because they're a really good way of repurposing a data center. But apart from that, I don't know. I don't know when the bubble is going to burst, but I do know, you know, per Stein's law, that anything that can't go on forever eventually stops. So what do we do when the bubble goes away? Well, not all bubbles are created equal. Some bubbles leave behind something productive and other bubbles leave behind nothing but ruin. All bubbles are bad, though. But if you think about two bubbles from sort of the dawn of my consciousness as a political and economic actor, one was WorldCom and the other one was Enron. And Enron was just a accounting swindle. They just lied about how their books worked. And as a result, when Enron was gone, there was nothing left behind. They just took the fortunes of everyone who trusted them. And Ken Lay died while awaiting his prison sentence, the CEO of Enron. And then there's WorldCom. WorldCom also lied about its accounting. But as part of that lie, they put endless miles of fiber in the ground because they lied about there being these huge orders for fiber optic cables. And when Bernie Ebers died in prison, that fiber stuck around. Bernie Ebers was the CEO of WorldCom. I'm currently talking to you using that fiber. So the fiber connecting my home here in Burbank is a two gigabit symmetrical link that AT&T provides over old WorldCom fiber that they bought and lit up. So that's what a good salvage can look like, a salvageable bubble. Cryptocurrency is not going to leave anything behind, just like, you know, ugly monkey art and shitty Austrian economics. But
my NFT token art
hold on to those. That's definitely a buy and hold. That's a value investment for the long term. Your kids are going to really thank you for having held on to those virtual Beanie Babies. So when the AI bubble bursts, we will have a bunch of stuff left over, right? We're going to have like data centers, and we're going to have open source models, and we're going to have, you know, skilled technicians, technologists who know how to use those things to make interesting things happen and who are looking for work. You know, how we make use of that is up to us, right? That is a political choice. There's no, it's not written in stone. And we have some precedent for this going well. So when the dot-com bubble burst and all the skilled technologists who had started off as humanities undergraduates but had been convinced to drop out and learn Perl and HTML and Python at the expense of, insurance companies and pension funds, those people suddenly could make the things that they wanted to make and not the things their stupid bosses thought they should make. And that's where we got Web 2, right? They could hire each other. They could buy servers for pennies on the dollar. Until not very long ago, my dining room set was a set of steel case leap chairs. These are $1,500 office chairs that I bought for $25 a piece from a dot-com founder who'd gone bust in the mission and was selling them like a Wall Street guy in 1929 selling apples from his Rolls Royce, you know? And like, there will be a lot of that. And again, I'm not saying that it's good or worth it. I'm saying that it is salvage that we should have an eye to, and that we should be thinking about how we're going to use. Because the only thing worse than squandering all of that and inflicting all this pain on people is doing all of it and getting nothing at the other end of it.
Well, and I would add, you know, you brought up the fascism thing, which is obviously the name of our podcast. I just had this sort of panic moment of thinking about this potential repeat we're in, right? I think a lot, you can explain a lot of the state of our politics by the fact of Obama coming in on hope and change, the financial crisis happening, and him responding by, you know, as the chant goes, banks got bailed out, we got sold out, no one responsible for it got arrested. And that, you know, that really laid the groundwork for Donald Trump. And so
they foamed the runways with the mortgages of ordinary lenders for the banks.
Exactly.
That was what Tim Geithner told Obama to do.
And that was the asset that was behind all of that securitization in 2008 was a house, right? It was like a real thing. This bubble, the asset is, you know, just total AI bullshit scam fairy dust. So anyway, it's going to be bad. And this does make me think that, like, as there's so much talk about 2028 and what are we doing to try to make sure that the right Democrat comes out, that Democrats are talking about the right things. This is making me feel like maybe the most important, one of the most important sets of work is using the 2028 primary to really elevate and force candidates to be answering the question of when this bursts, what are you going to do? What is the plan that is actually holding the folks responsible, accountable, not putting it all on to the regular people so that we don't have a redux of 2008 and then, you know, a full on extra fascism 4 years later.
And, you know, as a fully paid up Bernie bro, this is the thing that makes me really sad about Bernie and his $1.7 trillion plan or whatever it is to do a sovereign AI wealth fund. We should do sovereign funds for things that make money.
Yeah.
Right. Like, who wants to co-own this turkey of an asset and have it valued at the top of the market?
He's definitely on. Bernie's our guy. The Krita hype thing, like he needs to hear your talk on Krita hype because he's very much bought in. We want to be conscious of your time, but just as we're talking about this idea of accountability, one additional question out of the, you know, moving off of the AI, but you wrote this blog post, which then I wrote a piece in The Nation about because I was so struck by it. I thought it was so spot on, where you proposed this idea of a Nuremberg caucus. And just, you know, you just talked about the need for us to be actively talking about how are we going to hold these motherfucking fascists accountable. Yeah. Can you tell listeners a bit about that idea and what does come next?
Well, you know, we keep hearing from Dems, yeah, they're doing this terrible stuff, but we don't have the majorities. We can't make a change, right? We can't block them. We can do some procedural nonsense, but eventually it all goes through. What do you want us to do? And I'm like, well, at the very least, why don't you start planning for what you'll do when you have power? So we announce a Nuremberg caucus. We set aside courtrooms in Washington, D.C. for holding trials for people who commit gross crimes and misdemeanors, human rights offenses, and so on. We gather public dockets in which we construct the cases against people who are gleefully violating the law, violating the Constitution, and harming the people we love. We fill those dockets with evidence. We come up with witness lists. We put schedules up for those courtrooms. So, you know, whatever. President AOC takes office on January 20th, January 21st. We put Stephen Miller in the dock at this federal building. And then at the next federal building over, we're going to have J.D. Vance and whatever. And here's the list of witnesses we're going to call against them. This is the evidence against them. This is how we're going to punish them. And, you know, as a working journalist, the number of times I've run into someone who just said something just completely nonsensical and authoritarian and stupid, and I just reached into my bag, pulled up my National Union of Journalists card and hung it around my neck because I'm a member of the UK National Union of Journalists, took out a notebook and started writing down what they said and had them just completely flip out. Like, I didn't give you permission to write down what I said. And I'm like, are you a public official doing things in the public in the course of your duties? I don't think I need your permission to write down what you're saying. It puts the shits up people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in particular with ICE, I think we could do some really good stuff, right? So you sign up for ICE, you get, I think it's 50 grand of student debt relief and 60 grand cash bonus, or maybe it's the other way around. So these guys are selling out really cheap. We could offer $1 million bounties for any ICE chud who gives evidence that leads to the criminal conviction of another ICE chud for violating the human rights of people in America during the ICE pogroms. And the way these guys operate, they would immediately start shooting each other. They'd be like, why are you watching me? Why are you watching me murder this guy? Are you a snitch? Right. They would just immediately start like, just like absolutely freaking out, because they know that they're prepared to like violate the human rights of the people around them for a mere 50 grand. Imagine what they do for a million. 50's chump change. Right. And then, and I think that just like, to, if you want to like demoralize them, set the cats amongst the pigeons, kneecap their operational efficiency, we should start there. I think it'd be really, really effective, and it'd be super fun to watch.
It's like the Lord of the Rings scene where they bring the ring into the orc tower, and then, and Sam has to go in and he has to face like 200 orcs. And then he realizes they've literally all killed themselves entirely fixed the problem.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly what it's like. It's very exciting to contemplate.
Love it. You know? Well, Corey, this has been so great. Matt said, and we'll talk about this in the intro too, but really being just having your work and corpus like introduced to my life and starting to follow your stuff, it is just like, there's just, it's just a fire hose of really, really, really useful stuff. So everyone who is enough of an idiot to have not already been following you, definitely start following Corey.
Thank you so much.
We always have a final question, which is looking around the world right now, what is making you the most fearful and what is giving you the most hope?
Well, I think fearful is just obvious, right? It's the poly crisis. It's, you know, it's the fact that we are, everything that we're doing is making everything else harder to do. And we are facing a series of existential crises that only get worse. So that's the stuff I'm worried about. The stuff I'm hopeful about is that Comrade Trump can't stop doing praxis, right? Like if you ever wanted someone to convince the world not to use hydrocarbons or fossil fuels, there's Trump doing demand destruction in the Strait of Hormuz, right? You have like literally millions of people who've sold their gas stoves and bought induction tops, who sold their cars and bought EVs. And like, this is just gold, man, because normally the future composts the past, right? You have some EVs on the road and they're trickling on, but you have this kind of chicken and egg problem where until there's a lot of EVs, you don't build the charging stations. Until there's the charging stations, no one wants to buy an EV. But if you just like wipe out the whole ICE flight overnight because Trump just can't keep it in his pants and in the Gulf, and replace it with an all electric fleet, not only do you solve all of those chicken and egg problems, but you also now have a fleet that's aging in lockstep, which means that when there's a new generation of technology, we can replace all of them in one go because they're all going to reach their end of life around the same time. This is like, it is the ideal way of organizing an energy transition. We couldn't have done it without him. Donald Trump has created the Greta scene. Not just that, he's done more to convince people that they shouldn't trust American tech platforms than I've managed in 25 years of activism. I think we're real close to a post-American internet. He's creating the post-American century. You know, the wonderful November Kelly says, Donald Trump inherited a rigged poker game and he flipped the table over because he resented having to pretend to play it. And, you know, the rigged poker game was bad. And he's ended it.
There's one other thing that I'm optimistic about after what you're talking about. Do you guys know Whirly Ball? You ever played Whirly Ball?
Oh, yeah. That's like basketball on little bumper cars.
Yeah, it's
that
Chicago
thing. That was a big, I'm from Chicago. That was a big middle school birthday party scene.
It's an absolutely electric game. And it would do so well
in a data center.
Old data center.
Oh yeah.
Nice.
That's a world I can get down with. All of these rural communities get in a Whirly Ball. No one's gonna have a problem with that.
Yeah.
And if you guys ever want to see the sport of kings being played, go find a chess boxing match It's one round of speed chess, one round of boxing, typically played between a little guy who's good at chess and a big guy who's good at boxing. And the question is, can you put the big guy in checkmate before he hits you in the head so many times you can't play?
Yeah, that can be in the other wing of the data center. These data centers can just be multi-sport, you know, really hubs.
Well, thank you so much, Corey.
Thanks, Corey. Right, really nice to meet you.
Lovely to meet you too. Thank you.
The Fighting Fascism podcast is produced by Nick Damitz in collaboration with The Nation. Music by Horseradish. Questions, comments, concerns? Email us at fightingfascismpod@gmail.com.
And someday people will pick the flowers.
Oh,
bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao,
ciao, ciao.
Someday people will pick the flowers and say how beautifully they bloom. These are the flowers.